Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Booker T. Washington Speaks on this Saturday evening, the first day of July 2017. This is your host, Marshall Washington, Cabinus Abui, the senior male descendant of the Honorable Dr. Booker T. Washington, the famed African-American educator who said, cast down your buckets where you are, who founded the very famous and world-renowned Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute, later known simply as Tuskegee Institute and now known as Tuskegee University. We're thankful to be able to bring you this program this evening, which we have been presenting for the last nearly 6 months. And tonight, our special topic, our special presentation deals with the topic of Booker T. Washington's vision of industrial education for living, or education for living. Booker T. Washington wanted to see African Americans enter the all-powerful business and commercial world. We asked the question, in 2017, is the institution that Booker T. Washington established at Tuskegee, Alabama,
allowing us, or is the institution allowing him to achieve his vision of seeing African Americans enter the all-powerful business and commercial world, but not as mere employees, but as industrialists and business moguls, as they say. So in what ways is Tuskegee University doing that in 2017? And in what ways has Tuskegee University neglected to do that? And we also ask the question, how can African Americans come together to provide an education for living for our aspiring young people today? So this is what we're going to be talking about tonight. And while we're waiting for some of our invited guests to come on, we're going just to play a light jazz set just to relax the mood, and we'll be back with you in just... Well, I was just looking at a book, a pictorial presentation entitled Images of America, Tuskegee, and this was actually produced by Amalia K. Amakai and the late Mrs. Amelia Boynton Robinson. On the back cover, it gives a description of the town of Tuskegee. And it says, Tuskegee, Alabama is associated with Tuskegee University. The Tuskegee Airmen, Booker T. Washington, and George Washington Carver, named after the Tuskegee, the Indian tribe, Tuskegee. It is the site of the first law school in Alabama, and had local schools long before there was a public school system. Tuskegee Normal School for Colored Teachers, now Tuskegee University, was pivotal to the city being a beacon of African-American achievement for a century. The birthplace of civil rights icon Rosa Parks, radio host Tom Joyner, and singer Lionel Richie. It is where Olympic star Alice Coachman was dubbed the Tuskegee Flash, and where important court cases guaranteeing voting rights and equal opportunity or equal education were fought. The city was also the site of the infamous medical experiment that threatened to stain the school's triumphant legacy. And in this book, as I go through it, my attention is called to
the picture of Robert Robinson Taylor, who lived from 1868 until 1942. A very distinguished looking gentleman. And the inscription here beneath this picture says that he was the first academically trained African-American architect and the first black graduate of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He was recruited by Booker T. Washington while he was still a student, but he designed several private and public buildings in Cleveland, Ohio, after graduating from MIT in 1892, before arriving at Tuskegee in November of 1892. Then back in Cleveland from 1899 to 1902, he worked on his own and as a draftsman for the Charles W. Hopkinson architectural firm. Other than those years, Taylor's career was spent at Tuskegee as he returned to be the director of industries before becoming the vice principal in 1925. So Robert R. Taylor not only served as the architect that designed and built many of the buildings, some of which are still standing at Tuskegee, but he also served as the vice principal, which today would be called the vice president or provost. His buildings included the Science Hall, which is called Thrasher Hall, built in 1893, and the chapel, which was built over a period of 3 years from 1895 to 1898, and sadly was destroyed by fire, seriously destroyed by fire in 1957. And sadly, I actually watched the chapel burn to the ground, a magnificent building destroyed. And then the Oaks, which is the home, the family home of my great grandfather, Booker T. Washington, which was constructed in 1899. He designed that beautiful mansion, very functional mansion. And then Huntington Hall, which was the main academic building where I attended classes as a student when I was there at Tuskegee, then called Tuskegee Institute. And it was burned to the ground in 1991. I do believe that's the year. And that was a hallmark that sadly is there no longer. And then the four Emory dormitories, which were men's dormitories near the center of the campus. And then Dorothy Hall, which is still standing, which is the official guest house of Tuskegee University. And then the Institute's Carnegie Library, which is the Greek what we would call revival style building, which he also designed. And then the administration building, the Carnegie Library, by the way, was built in 1901. And then the administration building, where the president's office and the chief executive offices, as well as the business office, were located. And during my childhood, and even when I was a college student at Tuskegee, the office for the Tuskegee Institute postal address was located there in that building. And then Rockefeller Hall, a girls' dormitory, which was built in 1903. Douglas Hall, another girls' dormitory. And I mentioned Huntington Hall. And then Tantum Hall, another girls' dormitory. And then the Millbank Agricultural Building. And Tompkins Hall, which was the student cafeteria. And on the bottom floor, the ground floor, when I was a student there, was the student union activities location, where they had games room, game rooms, a cafe, and also offices for the student government, including the office that I occupied as the president of the class of 1968 in my sophomore year. And then Whitehall, another girls' dormitory, and John A. Andrew Memorial Hospital, which closed under the administration of Dr. Benjamin Peyton, but was the mainstay for medical care for Macon County during the time that I was growing up and while I was a student at Tuskegee, and for some years afterwards. And then the laundry, which had been later converted to the George Washington Carver Museum, and James Hall, then Logan Hall, which was the James Hall, was another girls' dormitory, and then Logan Hall, which was the gymnasium, and in the basement of Logan Hall was the swimming pool, indoor swimming pool, the only indoor swimming pool in the county. And this is where many of us who grew up in Tuskegee learned to swim. And then Sage Hall, and then the Wilcox Trade Buildings, and then the Armstrong Science Building, and the magnificent Hollis Burke Frizzell Library. And all of these were designed and built under the direction of Robert Robinson Taylor, who, as we mentioned earlier, I saw someone just joined us. And we welcome you to the program, and we certainly look forward to hearing from you as we do proceed into the program this evening. So we'll be bringing you on in just a few minutes. We want to make some introductory comments, so stay there. Don't leave us. We definitely want to hear from you. So we just wanted to share this with you because Tuskegee has a long and illustrious history, being the place where the first academically trained African-American architect made his mark in the field, in the world of architecture. And of course, there's a picture here of the beautiful Gothic style chapel that was built entirely by student labor. The bricks even were made by the students. And it was such an impressive experience for me in my childhood to attend services there in that chapel. And Booker T. Washington called it the most imposing building on the campus. They say it took over 3 years to build this. The students built it under the supervision of Robert Taylor and his staff. And one of the supporters of Tuskegee felt that this chapel epitomized the school's mission. And it was the first electric building in the county, the first building in the county to be wired for electricity. And ironically, very ironically, the fire marshal who inspected the ruins of the building after the ashes had cooled claimed that the building burned because of defective wiring, which I don't believe any of us that knew anything about the industriousness and diligence of the Tuskegee electricity students would ever believe that, because not only were these students told to be perfect in their work, but also to conduct regular maintenance on the wiring system to ensure that any eroding electrical circuits or electrical wires were immediately replaced so that there would be no chance that they would overheat. And the other irony is the fact that the chapel burned in the middle of the night when there were no lights on. So how could fire be attributed to an electricity issue when those of us who have studied electricity realize that when there's no voltage, no power going through the wires, when the lights are shut off, the wires are cool. It's only when there's electricity going through the wires that they begin to heat up. And then if the insulation is decayed, then the heat may cause the insulation to combust. But at night, at 11 or 12 o'clock at night, when the lights had been turned off for several hours and the wires had had a chance to cool down, how could that have happened? So we really believe that somebody did that purposely. And that feeling was enforced by the fact that a week before the beautiful chapel burned, there was a KKK cross that was planted on the lawn right in front of the chapel, actually to the rear of the chapel as it is now, because the new chapel is constructed. But it was a beautiful building, and I'm looking at a picture, a very dignified looking student sitting in the chapel, all dressed in a somewhat of a uniform. And I remember as a child sitting on a lawn, actually it was like a knoll, overlooking the main street of the campus called Campus Avenue. Now they've named it Booker T. Washington Avenue. And watching the students march to the chapel, they would begin down on the end of Campus Avenue, right by the administration building. The band would proceed, and following them would be the male military cadets, because all of the male students that were not physically impaired would be enrolled in the campus cadet corps, and they would wear military uniforms and be taught drill, and they would march in perfect unison, in step, behind the band, with their officers parading either in front of them or on the side. And following them would be the young ladies in long, dark, navy blue dresses, ankle-length dresses. Of course, that was earlier when I went to school there. There were dresses that came a couple of inches below the knees, stockings, and shoes, pumps, or not very high heel shoes. But they would have on white blouses. In the fall, they would have a cape, a waist-length cape to cover the white blouses. And I believe their heads would be bare, but perhaps they did have a handkerchief or something on their heads. I don't remember. And then as I look through here, I see many other pictures that impressed me with the mission of Tuskegee in its early days. They studied things like carpentry and upholstery, things that they could employ themselves with after graduating from Tuskegee in their communities. But what I want to do at this time, because we're going to only do a show for an hour tonight, and next week we will not be on the show. We will not do the show next week. I have to go to Tuskegee, actually, to attend a memorial service for a dear friend of mine and my family's. And so we will suspend the show for next week, but the following week we will be back. And so before I turn it over to our guests for comments, I want to read something that was written by a gentleman that I know well. His name is Mr. Lee Walker, and he is the president of the New Coalition for Economic and Social Change, and is a senior fellow of the Heartland Institute. And in 2008, the Heartland Institute published a book entitled Booker T. Washington, A Re-Examination. And in the front of the book, on one inside page, there's a picture of Booker T. Washington looking very distinguished. And on his left is Andrew Carnegie, the industrialist, And then to his right is U.S. Secretary of War William H. Taft, who became President Taft. And then Robert C. Ogden, a philanthropist. And these were people that were supporters of Tuskegee and supporters of Booker T. Washington. Now, we're going to get into the meat of what we're going to talk about for just a few minutes. Mr. Lee Walker said that he had composed a symposium to discuss Booker T. Washington's relevance in 2008. Now, it's even more important that we talk about his relevance in 2017. So he says that first and foremost, Booker T. Washington advocated quality education for black children and adults. He understood that in the aftermath of slavery, the freed men and women needed schools that could teach them to read, something that was illegal under slavery, so that they could develop the understanding and the skills required of productive citizens. And then a second theme in his life, closely tied education, was self-reliance. Tuskegee University, which was now named Tuskegee University, but when I went to school there, it was Tuskegee Institute, began as the normal school in Tuskegee, Alabama. For those of you that don't know the history of education, normal schools were elementary schools that primarily taught the students reading, writing, and arithmetic and civics and some of the basic sciences, but the purpose was to inculcate in the students the basic values of good citizenship. Now, I went to an elementary school which wasn't called a normal school. It was a parochial school, but the basic things that we were taught in addition to the essential academic skills were things related to character building. And as a young person, 11, 12, 13, 14 years old, I was active in the Boy Scouts of America program and became an Eagle Scout, which is the top rank of Boy Scouting. And we were taught some basic principles of character. And we were taught that a scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. And these principles are called norms, N-O-R-M-S. Norms also mean standards or qualities. And so normal schools were designed to teach the young people standards of excellence, of character, qualities of good citizenship. And so Tuskegee was designated as a normal school. And it goes on to say in this article that it focused on training black men and women to become skilled at building, farming, and other occupations so they could earn their way into mainstream American society. The operative word here is earn their way. Earn their way. Because Booker T. Washington was convinced, as he wrote in Up From Slavery in 1901, that the actual site of a first-class house that a Negro has built is 10 times more potent than pages of discussion about a house that he ought to build or perhaps could build. And then we'll close with this note. A third theme of Booker T. Washington was entrepreneurship. Living at a time of intense racism and segregation, Booker T. Washington encouraged thousands of black men and women to look at the need for goods and services in their communities as an opportunity to start their own businesses. So in 1900, he founded the first Black Businessmen's Association, the National Negro Business League. He personally helped many Black businesses get started by introducing Black entrepreneurs to white investors. So we're going to stop right there. There's more that we could say. This book is potent with great information about the real Booker T. Washington, and we can discuss what I mean by that at another time. But at this time, I want to welcome all of you who are listening via the internet and who have those who have come on to be participants in our discussion. So at this time, we'd like to open up the floor, as they say, open up the mic to our caller, who I believe is from California, but I'm not sure, from a 562 area code. How are you tonight?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm just going to be listening in tonight. No comment.
Okay, well, good. Well, welcome, and you're certainly very, very welcome to be listening in tonight. I'm going to continue as we wait for other callers that may want to share the microphone with us tonight. I do want to return back to that theme that I was discussing just a few minutes ago, and that was the theme of self-reliance. Booker T. Washington spoke about casting down one's bucket where we are, casting down our bucket where we are. This is a theme and a very important speech that he made that catapulted him to national prominence in 1895. He said, and I quote, "To those of my race who depend on bettering their condition in a foreign land, or who underestimate the importance of preserving friendly relationships with the southern white man who is their next door neighbor, I would say, cast down your bucket where you are. Cast it down, making friends in every manly way of all people, in every manly way of the people of all races by whom you are surrounded." And then he followed that up by saying, to those of the white race who look to the incoming of those of foreign birth, and mind you, this was a time when many immigrants were beginning to come from Europe seeking their fortunes in the United States. So he's addressing the people that are settled in America who have opened their arms, so to speak, to the Europeans that were coming from some of the ravaged or poor countries in Europe. So he says, to those of the white race who look to the incoming of those of foreign birth and strange tongue and habits for the prosperity of the South, were I permitted, I would repeat what I have said to my own race. Cast down your bucket where you are. Cast it down among the 8 millions of Negroes whose habits you know, whose fidelity, meaning faithfulness and love, you have tested in days when to have proved treacherous meant the ruin of your fireside. What he's referring to here is that the men folks of the southern homes went off to war during the Confederacy rebellion against the federal government of the United States, known as the Civil War. And they left the Negroes in charge of protecting their families from marauders and deserters. And they trusted these Negroes to be faithful in that they would make sure that their families were taken care of and protected while the men folks were gone. So he says, whose faithfulness and love you have tested, when to have proved treacherous meant the ruin of your fireside. So cast down your bucket among these people who have without strikes and labor wars tilled your fields, cultivated your fields, and cleared your forests, and builded your railroads and your cities, and brought forth treasures from the bowels of the earth. So he's saying that the Black people are the best people to be the ones to be relied upon to help build the what was called the New South. And so Mr. Walker, Lee Walker, goes on to explain this, and he says that cast down your bucket was the advocacy, not of resignation or passive accommodation, but of self-initiated and self-responsible action. At the 1922 unveiling of the Booker T. Washington Memorial, which is a very, very poignant, large-scale representation showing Booker T. Washington standing over a slave that's kneeling, actually sitting on an anvil with a book in his lap, a large book in his lap, with tools of the trade of building by his side. And he's looking forward as though he sees hope in the future under the leadership of Booker T. Washington, as Booker T. Washington is lifting a veil from over his head. And the inscription on the monument says that he lifted the veil of ignorance from his people and showed them the way to industry. And so when this statue was unveiled, a gentleman said of Booker T. Washington that he changed a crying race into a trying race and put in their hands the wonderful crafts of the age. He instilled in their minds the dignity of labor and urged them to stop marking time, but to keep pace with the grand march of civilization. So cast down your bucket where you are is a methodology of progress, not of passivity and stagnation. So when we think about Booker T. Washington now in this day and time, we have to understand that he was teaching us that character is power. And he was teaching us that we should have value for the real things of life and not get caught up in illusions. He gave the example in a story he told that he said, we want also, as he spoke to his students, we want also to be sure that we remain simple in our dress and in all our outward appearance. I do not like to see a young man who is poor and whose tuition is being paid by someone else and who has no books, sometimes has no socks, sometimes has no decent shoes, wearing a stiff, white, shiny collar, which was the vogue of that time, these stiff collars, which he had sent away to be laundered. I do not like to ask people to give money for such a young man as that, because he would go throughout the country soliciting donations to help the students with their expenses. But he said someone that has this superficial set of values that he couldn't do his own collars when he didn't have proper equipment for school. He didn't like to have people give money for those students. He wanted the young man to learn that it was better to learn to launder his collars himself than to pretend to be what he was not. As he explained to the student, when you send a collar to the city laundry, it indicates that you have a bank account. It indicates that you have money ahead and can afford luxury. Now, I do not believe that you can afford it, and that kind of expense and that kind of acting do not pay. Yet, right down to business, as I have said, if we, speaking of the student-run campus laundry, cannot do up your collars well enough to suit you, why, get some soap and water and start here and learn to launder your own collars. And he said that freedom is serious business. So we're going to stop right on that note. Freedom is serious business. And the serious business, going back to our theme, for those of you that may have just joined us, and we'll bring you on in just a second,
But our topic for this evening is centered around Booker T. Washington's vision of education for living. Booker T. Washington wanted to see African Americans enter the all-powerful business and commercial world as business owners, not just as employees, but as moguls of business enterprises, as industrial giants. And so we asked the question, in 2017, is the institution, which we knew before when I was a student there as Tuskegee Institute, but now it's known as Tuskegee University, is the institution that Booker T. Washington established following him to achieve his vision of helping the African Americans to become business leaders, business giants, industrial giants? And in what ways is Tuskegee University doing that? In what ways is Tuskegee University helping people that are students there learn how to be business leaders? And in what ways has Tuskegee neglected to do that? And then finally, how can African Americans come together to provide an education for living? And this is generalized, not just talking about Tuskegee, but in general. And I invite you all, as I call you on to the mic, you may ask this question without necessarily relating it to Tuskegee, but in general, how can African Americans come together to provide an education for living for our aspiring young people today? And so with that said, we have several callers, and I'm going to go and I'm going to ask our caller who had indicated a few minutes ago that she wanted to just listen, but I'll give you another chance to think about that before I go to the next person. So our California caller, do you still want to just listen, or would you like to comment on what we said so far?
Well, I just, I'm sorry. I think I still want to just listen today.
That's fine. Okay, well, thank you. So now we're going to go on to our caller from the 518 area code. The last two digits of the phone number are 43. I know you just came on and you didn't probably hear a lot of what we talked about, but I think you got the gist of what we're conversing about this evening, which is economic self-reliance, the building of economic independence or industry for African American people. Would you like to comment on that? That's inviting you from our 518 area code. The last two digits of your phone number are 43, and we are inviting you now to come on and participate if you would like to. If you don't want to say anything, we understand. Okay, so we didn't get any response, so I suppose you just want to listen. We had someone on just a minute ago, and they just dropped off, and I was hoping that they would come on and give us the benefit of their input, but they did just drop off. And so we have someone from Augusta, Georgia, I do believe, area code 706, the last two digits of the phone number are 36. Would you like to speak now and give us your opinion about what we've talked about?
You know, good evening, everybody. Assalamu alaikum, peace and blessing. I'm one person in California today. I really just want to listen. But all I can say is that I think that it's essential that we instill in our students that they need to have their individual life goals established, and that these goals should be carefully designed and be consistent with diagnostic prescriptive instructions that address with respect to their current progress through early intervention to help each student achieve your goal, and to have the highest priority and practicality by giving special considerations to the curriculum, planning, and instruction. That's all I have to say.
Okay, well, that's very, very important. We actually do follow that advice. And while we're talking about curriculum, I just want to share something that I think is very, very critical that we think about today. As we know, many of our students are failing to graduate from high school. Some of them are leaving the eighth grade, or in some cases where they go from the sixth grade into middle school, but they're entering into the senior years of their basic educational program unprepared. Many students are going into ninth grade, they can barely read and write. They can't do simple mathematics, division and multiplication or factoring or fractions. And we know that the teachers are trying very hard, but they have to have students to come to school ready to pay attention and ready to learn. And in some cases, they have obstacles that they cannot easily overcome. And one of those obstacles is peer pressure, not to appear to be very smart. And sometimes when students do the work and show that they have studied and they are ready for class, they've done their homework and they know the lesson, and those that decided to fritter away the evening hours after school and just play, who haven't taken the time to prepare for the next day's lessons, they would jeer at the students that have done their work and even bully them and threaten them. I remember the case of a young man who I watched grow up here in Augusta, Georgia. I remember when he was probably in about the sixth or seventh grade, and his mother would bring him to the university library where I'm employed as a tutor and as a professor there on the campus. And she would guide him in his homework assignments to make sure he was diligent. And he progressed on through high school as an honor student, not high school, but elementary school, and then high school as an honor student. And she came to the library one day, and she was very distraught, and she told me that some of the classmates of this boy had waited until after school was out, and as soon as he got off the school grounds, they followed him up the street, and about four or five boys jumped on him and beat him up. And if it was not for a Korean shopkeeper that threatened to call the police, they might have even seriously harmed that boy, killed him. Why would they want to do something like that to this student that was aspiring not only to make his mother proud of him, but his church members and the community, his teachers, and prepare himself for a future where he could go, because he came from a single-parent family. I don't know if his mother had any other children. He was the only one that she brought to that library for study. And I have seen mothers bring four or five children there to study, but she only brought him, so I'm led to believe maybe he was the only child of that mother. And I'm sure that his goal is and was to prepare himself by going on to college and getting into a good profession where he could help his mother, take care of his mother. But why would some students in the classroom be so hostile to that idea that they would want to seriously harm that boy, beat him up, maybe even have killed him? So we have a problem, and the problem starts with the mentality that has been allowed to persist among our young people. So I'm going to ask some of you that are listening, what do you believe that we can do to change that mentality among our young people of hostility to good performance? Ooh, so I'm going to go back over the list, and I see we have a call. As I had called on you before, you may want to speak this time from the 518 area code. The last two digits are 4-3. Would you like to share your thoughts on this?
Oh.
Okay. I'm not sure if you're hearing me, but the 518 area code caller, the last two digits of your number are 43. Would you like to share your thoughts on this tonight? Okay. I don't know. Maybe you're ready to speak. So we're going to move on. Caller from North Carolina, from the 88 area code.
Okay.
And we are going
to
invite you.
Me?
I can hear someone. Yes, go ahead.
That's North Carolina. That is me, Stephanie Reynolds. Hi, everyone.
Stephanie.
How are you?
We're fine.
Yes,
we're
I would like to elaborate a little bit on what you were talking about, because I also have an only son, and he was an A student in school. But like I said before, this stuff begins in the home. You know, teaching them in the home, also with the school, it gives them a great start. Now, when my son was young, I knew who his friends were. I knew who his classmates were. I was a volunteer worker at the school, and I've been a volunteer worker at several schools, even after my son was grown. And that's what we can do in the community to help out. I was a volunteer reading instructor, and I teach children who couldn't hardly read. You know, I also in the English department. Those are my two good subjects. I couldn't help a child out in math. My son was excellent in it, thank God. But we just like last week, LaShawn Hill was on, and she is a student at UCLA. And she was saying that's one of the things that's lacking. They don't have enough tutors. Now, and when they do have tutors, it might cost too much, and the tutors are stretched real thin. So getting out there and volunteering really helps a lot with these students, you know. And when you get to know your child's friends and peers and classmates, it also makes it easier on the child, from being bullied and things like that. It works. It really does. Getting out there and just helping, that's something that we can all do from time to time. There's a school near everyone, and it's not that hard. Just a little bit of help goes a long way. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. We thank you very much for your contribution. We're only going to go until 10 o'clock tonight, but we do want to entertain any more comments. And before we ask again for our callers to comment, we want to mention again something that is often overlooked today. And that is the idea of us building an economy in our own community. I'm going to say it briefly, but we've become so dependent, not only as communities of African American people, but also as a nation. We've become so dependent. Are so dependent, rather, on other people providing us with things we need. Now, what I mean by that is, to give an example, when I was a child, people had farms near me, and what they would do on Saturday morning, they would bring produce from their farm, and they would sell this produce from the curves of the street near my home. They would unload their wagons, and they would have tables set up, and people would come by. They would park their cars in a nearby parking lot, and they would walk over to the what they call curb market, and they would buy very, very good, organically produced fresh vegetables, eggs, and milk, fresh butter, And they would be, of course, healthier because this was all natural food. And people that owned these small farms were able to make a living. And then you had people who set up small grocery stores that would import fresh vegetables from these farms. And we had our own economy in Tuskegee. We had people that could actually make shoes. Most of the people went to the regular stores and bought the shoes, but they knew that if they needed to have the shoes repaired, there were two or three people in the community that actually operated the shoe repair shops. And they had tailors. I remember as a teenager having, I worn out a pair of my pants. I had a suit, and I loved that suit so much, I pretty much wore it to death, so to speak. And so when the bottom wore out, I was able to take the suit to one of the tailors, and he rewove the bottom of the suit. They had skilled people that could do everything. And so what I'm saying is that spirit of doing for self needs to come back. We're so dependent
yes.
on having everybody else take care of our needs that we have lost that sense that we can do so much more in our own community. You know, and another thing is we get ready to close because you said we're going to stop at 10. But I remember back in the day when if you had people over at your house on Saturday evening and maybe you hadn't had a chance to go to the store during the morning on Saturday for some reason or another to refurbish some necessary items like maybe your sugar, and people came and you wanted to serve them coffee or tea, or maybe you wanted to do some baking and you needed some sugar but you didn't have enough to go do everything, you could always go next door and borrow a cup of sugar. People didn't mind you knocking on their door. Usually back in those days, in the springtime, the summertime, and early fall, the people would have the door open and the screen door would be there, and they might lock the screen door. I remember a time when they didn't even lock the screen door, but you had enough sense not to just walk in their house. But you would stand at the screen door and you would call them. You might knock on the door. You might ring the doorbell, but a lot of times, because these houses weren't really very large, and you would just call them and say, "Hey, Mrs. Reed, that's my next door neighbor." And Mrs. Reed would come, she said, "Yes, how can I help you?" Mama said, "Could you loan us a cup of sugar?" She said, "Sure, just wait a minute, I'll be right back." And she would come back with a cup of sugar. She might have a mason jar and put the sugar in the mason jar because she wouldn't necessarily want that back. So she didn't have to worry about her cup not coming back. Not that my mother would keep her cup, but a lot of times they'd give us the cup or they may give us the container to put the sugar in and we could keep it. But then the next time she might need some flour, she'd come over to our house and, "Could you help me out? I need some flour. I'm getting ready to make some pancakes or something like that, and I need some flour." And we trade it off all the time like that. Same
That's
thing
right.
about, you know, if somebody needed to get their car fixed. We had several mechanics in the neighborhood, and even though it was later in my young days when one of the black men got a mechanical shop, but they would come over to your house, you know, they call them shade tree mechanics, and they'd jack your car up, go into your car, you know, fix your car, and then the next time you might be able to fix a TV. TVs were just coming in style when I was about 20. And they come over to your house and say, "Look, my TV is on the blink. I don't know what's wrong with it, but could you look at it?" And the same guy who had fixed somebody's car, now he needs that guy who was the electrician that got his car fixed to come over and watch the TV. So we always were trading off like that. And what that did, it built a spirit of community life amongst us where we were dependent on each other. We didn't have these walls set up. Artificial walls set between us where we didn't even say much to each other. And that was a time that I really loved to think about. And finally, what I want to say about this is also and this is a great memory of mine. You know, if a child was walking on the street after that most people had gone inside for dinner, somebody would go out there to the street and say, "What are you doing? Your mama's looking for you." I know she is. She hasn't called me yet, but I know she's going to be calling around in a few minutes, wondering what happened to you, so you better hurry up and get home. It takes a village to raise a child. And when I grew up, it was a small business-like community, and everybody had that spirit. But I'm saying that even in our larger communities and our larger cities within that two or three block area, people need to learn who lives in that neighborhood, who the children are in that neighborhood, and take responsibility for those children. So that's all I want to say right now.
Thank you.
And my wife, Jackie, is here standing beside me in the studio, and she would like to say something. So, dear Jackie, you'd like to go in and have a seat. Excuse me. She's going to take over.
I'm not going to take over for too long, but assalamu alaikum to and I just wanted to say regarding our children that as parents, we, you know, we have to push good values and good ideas to our children. We have to be, you know, good role models to them and to be able just to be there for them because they go through so much in today's world. And there are so many subtle changes, like when Marshall was talking about the young guy and his mom and how peer pressure got to him. But you have to be there for them. You have to continue to push them through this particular
time.
Be
involved.
Yeah, because it's not, you know, you're going to lose them to the bad influences. And you have to keep in your child's life because sooner or later, they, you know, they are going to be faced with bad ideas and low values in this life. And we have to be there for them. And we have to continuously listen and give good and sound advice, good godly advice, no less than that. No less. But that was my comment for tonight. And we just have to be good parents. Good parents. No matter what comes, we have to be good parents. But anyway, that's all I have to say for tonight. And good night.
Thank
Marshall,
you.
Going to close the show. Okay, and assalamu alaikum to everyone.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Thank you to dear sweet Jackie. We can always be sure that whenever we hear a voice, we're going to have a good feeling when she finishes because that's how she is.
Amen.
She brings up good feelings. So I hope that you have said what you had wanted to say, but in case there's something that's still lingering on your mind that in the last few seconds, minutes of this program you would like to get out to our audience, we'll give you one more round to go. About thinking about it and say what you'd like to say. So we're going to go back. I know I've asked you twice, but three times is a charm. So I'm going to ask our 562 caller, would you like to make a contribution now that you heard your Aunt Jackie say something?
Not tonight. Thank you.
Okay. You're being very, very quiet and reticent. We respect that. So now we have our caller. Yes, of course. From area code 706, Augusta, Georgia. We certainly would like to hear your final closing comments. Would you like to say something?
No, I don't have anything else to say, man. Thank you. Anyway.
Okay, well, that's fine. That's fine. Not a problem. Not a problem. So now we're going to go back to our 518 area code caller. And we know that it seems like you've been wanting to be silent tonight, but we'll give you this opportunity before we close. Would you like to make a contribution?
Assalamu alaikum, Imam and everyone. This is Sister Shireen Ali from Schenectady, New York. And I'm sorry I came late into your show tonight, but it's a pleasure as always from hearing from you and Sister Jackie and the rest of the Jumat. Jazakallah. Assalamu alaikum.
Well, thank you very much. And, Stephanie, we did hear from you. We'll give you one more opportunity if you want to add something before we close. Would you like to go ahead?
Thank you. Just a little something for our young people. We need to constantly give them some positive affirmations and build up their confidence, too. Because me, even as an old lady, I love it when someone gives me a positive affirmation. It keeps me striving on what I need to do when I hear good things from other people. So we need to reach out and do that to each other, and especially to our young people. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Great. Well, I just want to make a closing comment, and that is we really appreciate all of you who've taken the time out this evening to come on the show to listen or to participate. We know we have another audience that is the internet audience, and so those of you who didn't call in but are listening via the internet, we certainly thank you for taking the time to listen to this program, and we hope that you will have gained something in terms of a spirit of hope, because that's what we really need right now. There are a lot of things that are going on. We read about, we hear them on the radio, we see them on the TV, and we won't go into the details. I don't need to remind you of some tragedies that are going on every single day around us. Black on black crime, blacks murdering blacks, police murdering blacks, people getting laid off of work, people getting thrown out of their houses, people not being able to get medical care because they don't have insurance, and all kinds of tragedies where people are being forced to evacuate because of the bad weather that we're having more and more of every year in this country. So many things, but I think the main thing is that, first of all, we have to remember one thing, and I'm not afraid to say this on the air, that there's a God somewhere, and that God is watching over his flock, and he
Amen.
Is punishing the wicked. And if we want to be safe from his anger, we need to stay on his good side. Because as sure as I'm sitting here and as sure as God made little green apples, he's going to put a whipping on the bad people sooner than a lot of people think. So when we see
Amen.
Ourselves leaning towards doing something that we know is going to get him angry with us, we need to check ourselves and say, God, I didn't really think that I was going to do that. I was just tempted to do it, but I know you didn't want me to do it, so I'm not going to do it. And then get back in his good grace by doing the things that we know are right for us. So as a people, and I'm talking mostly about African Americans, but this applies to everyone, but as a people, we need to go back and study our Bible. For the Muslims, study the Quran and the Bible. All of you should read the Quran. It's a great book, even if you are a member of a church. It's still going to help you to read the Quran, because I'm going to tell you a little secret a lot of y'all don't know. But your church leaders are reading the Quran almost every day, because many of them belong to a secret society where it's a requirement for them to read the Quran, but they're just not supposed to share it with you. So I'm telling you, it's all right for you to read the Quran because your ministers are reading it. In fact, I remember about 10 years. Yes, I remember about 10 years ago, I was lining up the mosque after having given the sermon that we have a service on Friday. And just as I was locking up the building, a car sped into the parking lot. And I was like taken aback because all the people that normally come, they knew by now that the service would be over and no need to be speeding up trying to catch it because it would be over. So when the people drove up, I went over to the car and I said, how y'all doing? May I help you this afternoon? They said, we are ministers and we need to get some Quran because we are going through this process of getting in this secret society and they require us to get some Quran because we're supposed to learn the Quran. So don't think it's anything that's wrong with the Quran, because those top people in the ministry and in the government, they know the Quran better than a lot of people that go to the mosque every day. So I'm just saying, though, wherever you have to go to get the Word of God, go to your Bible, go to your Quran, but find out what God says he's going to bless you for doing and do as much of that as you can. And one of the things, and I'm going to close on this note, yes, I am a preacher for those on the internet that are listening. I did not introduce myself on this show as a preacher, but I am a preacher. And I would say this, when Jesus was on this earth and when he was teaching the people, there were people that tried to undermine him because they didn't want to change their status quo because they were actually charging the false teaching. And so he was busting that up. So they tried to trap him because they had studied all of these different laws because God had made them have to go and learn a lot of different laws on many different areas to try to help straighten them out. So they came to Jesus thinking that they could trap him and maybe that he didn't know all these laws. So they said, Rabbi, they called him Rabbi because he grew up in a family of rabbis. So they said, you know, basically they said, teacher, tell us what is the law. And like, you know, they was wanting to see if he knew the law. He said, I'm going to tell you what the law is. Listen to me. He said, the law is in two parts. He said, the first part, he said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole heart, with thy whole mind, thy whole soul.
Ooh,
and, then he said, the second one is like unto the first. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. So if we keep that in mind, if we keep that in mind, to make God be the first in our life, as they say, the Alpha and Omega, the first and the last, and let it encompass everything that we do, and then we do for our family and we do for our neighbors the same we would want people to do for us, then we're going to be fine. We're going to be fine as a family. We're going to be fine as individuals, and we're going to be fine as a community. But we will not be fine if we keep disregarding the things that God tells us to do and doing all the things he say don't do. And it's either or. We can't have our cake and eat it too. We can't be on one side of the street and the other side at the same time. So Booker T. Washington, going back to him as we close, what he did, the first thing he did when the people got to Tuskegee, the first thing he did, he said, I want y'all to go down to the well and I want y'all to pump a bucket of water. And I want y'all to clean your face and clean your hands and clean your feet. A lot of them were barefoot, didn't even have shoes. Then I want you to come over here to this church because he started Tuskegee inside of a church. And I want y'all to sit down because we're going to have somebody read the Bible to y'all so you can get your mind on God. So
that's right.
When I was in the freedom movement, when I was in the civil rights movement in the 60s, we had a song. We say, I woke up this morning with my mind, Lord, mind on freedom. But the freedom we're talking about is not the freedom from Jim Crow. It's not the freedom from Bull Connor or Sheriff Jim Clark or George Wallace or some of those other mean people. It's freedom from the devil chaining us up doing stuff we shouldn't be doing. So let's wake up in the morning with our mind, folks, our mind on freedom. Thank you very much. We're going to play some nice soft music to close out, and we hope that you have enjoyed this show, and we hope that you'll join us, not next Saturday, because we won't be on next Saturday, but the Saturday after next, and we're going to have some more good conversation about our people and what we need to do to be able to come up from slavery and get right. Excuse me, that wasn't the one. Here we go. Thank you.